This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org. Nadine Gordimer with Steve Wasserman. Recorded in Santa Fe, December 3, 2003. Nadine Gordimer, the 1991 Nobel Prize-winning novelist whose work interweaves history, culture, and politics from her native South Africa, here reads The Generation Gap, one of the stories in her collection entitled Loot, before joining in conversation with then-editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review, Steve Wasserman.
Nadine Gordimer once remarked that she tried to write posthumously. She did not mean she wanted to speak from beyond the grave, but that she aimed to communicate as if she were already dead. This is an exacting, nearly unobtainable standard. But it is the right one, for it enables a writer to embody Einstein's injunction to remember your humanity and forget the rest. For decades, South Africa was enmeshed in a web of lies that went by the name apartheid. The model citizen was one with neither memory nor backbone. Nadine Gordimer's refusal to relinquish either is among her greatest achievements. She knows that the chaos of daily events, whether in the life of a people or in the flickering wick of individual lives, can only be understood through the prism of history. Her distinctive way of touching the relation of historical reality to the lives of individuals is a feat rare among writers who otherwise find themselves hostage to history. Her work gives us the unmistakable quality that only real writers possess, a sun-like force that wilts cliché and bollocks the categories of expectation. Her writing, both her fiction and nonfiction, is a vast rumination on the presence of history in ordinary life, the way the past, as was once so famously observed, weighs on the brain of the living like a nightmare. Thus, history is not a chronicle of the dead or an anima to be illuminated by some doctrine, but an immense, sometimes subtle force inhering in what people see and feel, and in the ways we see and feel. The triumph of her art is to immerse her characters, and we, her lucky readers, in the tidal force of history without drowning in those turbulent waters. Thus, the engulfing, ferocious historical reality that formed the corrupting maelstrom of apartheid appears as our common habitat, not a well of horrors to be borrowed for rhetorical thunder, not an occasion for polemical punditry, not a backdrop for sensibility, but an enormous swirling canvas of humanity with an awesome power to confer nobility on the ceaseless and remorseless struggle for survival, self-realization, and transcendence. In a wider sense, her work forms a bridge between the three parallel enterprises of history, culture, and politics. It reveals how culture justifies itself by history, how history influences culture, and how politics threads its way through both. Politics, of course, as you all know, can be a fatal attraction for an artist. In the work of literature, Stendhal once famously said, "Politics is like a pistol in the middle of a concert. Its shot is loud and vulgar, and yet it is a thing not possible to ignore." Gordimer has always refused to sacrifice truth on the altar of beauty, for she knows there can be no beauty if it is paid for by human injustice, nor truth that passes over injustice in silence, nor moral virtue that condones it. She knows that aesthetics is no substitute for ethics, nor can there be any compromise with conscience, for that too is a corruption of the spirit. She is an author whose optimism has never succumbed to cynicism, and for half a century now, she has used her pen to discomfort the powerful and succor the weak. And above all, she knows the important question is always, for whom? Nadine Gordimer is a writer of fundamental decency, whose abhorrence of injustice and love of truth is palpable on every page of her remarkable work. Her belief in reason, in moral sobriety, in resistance to evil, her embrace of sentiment without sentimentality, her ever-deepening sense of outrage, undimmed by age, is as refreshing as it is rare. Her steadfast and ardent opposition to the pornography of power, her acute understanding of the dialectics of domination, and her exploration of the pathology of prejudice is exemplary. In her fiction, as in her nonfiction, she seeks to disentangle the myriad threads of a vast tapestry of fear, shame, and guilt that together form a pattern that coarsens and blunts the human spirit and is the price of indifference. Her work charts the tragic trajectory of oppression and gives us the anatomy and the conditions of South Africa, both in the age of apartheid and since, of a self-inflicted constriction of the human capacity for love and empathy and self-realization. She understands what Philip Toynbee knew. The writer's gift to the reader is not social zest or moral improvement or love of one's country, but an enlargement of the reader's apprehension. Moreover, Nadine Gordimer has known, whether intuitively or consciously or some admixture of both, I do not know, but perhaps we shall find out this evening, exactly how to perform this miracle. She has often cited the director Satyajit Ray's observation that it is the presence of the essential thing in a very small detail which one must catch in order to expose larger things. Nadine Gordimer's method in her 13 published novels and 16 collections of stories and essays is that of the magnifying glass. Under her scrutiny, no important detail of our time has passed unnoticed. And like the magnifying glass, a ray of truth caught in Gordimer's lens for too long becomes concentrated light. It catches fire. Moreover, her refusal to simplify the world and her recognition of the ambiguity in human affairs has not condemned her to moral paralysis. Rather, it has made possible the lucidity which so many of us seek, but which so few of us find. Nor has she sacrificed a love of paradox and gift of irony on the altar of political correctness. She knows, as every true writer must, that the trouble with the world, as one of the characters in Jean Renoir's film, The Rules of the Game, remarks, the trouble with the world is that everyone has his reasons. And this means that the writer must meet a very high standard indeed, a standard best articulated by Chekhov, who said that the integrity of a writer resides in the ability to describe a situation so truthfully that the reader can no longer evade it. Or as Gordimer herself has written, nobility in ordinary men and women is to be found only among their doubts, culpabilities, shortcomings, their courage in spite of. The writer, she insists, must hold high the lantern of artistic truth that reveals human worth through human ambiguity. But this obligation means no diminution of one's passion for justice. Nadine Gordimer well understands that religions and states, classes and tribes, nations and factions have their true believers always to hand. Indeed, they form the toxic brew of our enduring fanaticisms. Less plentiful, alas, are the defenders of the ideas of secularism, libertarianism, internationalism, and solidarity. It is these ideas, perennially under siege, that stand in need of constant reaffirmation. Fealty to such principles is not to be confused with blind adherence. Upon accepting the 1991 prize for the Nobel Prize for Literature, Nadine Gordimer observed that the author serves humanity only as long as he utilizes the word against his own loyalties too. Agitprop, she has remarked more than once, binds the artist with the means by which it aims to free the minds of the people. By contrast, literature liberates. And in Nadine Gordimer, we have the gift of a writer whose literary felicities and moral constancy provide a trove of truth-telling and whose work, like all great art, turns us inside out and enables us to see the world with fresh eyes. It is a high honor and a great personal privilege to welcome to this stage tonight, here in Santa Fe, Nadine Gordimer.
Good evening, everybody. I'm most indebted and grateful to Lannan for giving me this opportunity to tell you a bedtime story. I'll be watching the clock. I've selected a story. If it doesn't fill the time allotted to me, then I may tack on another little one. But the story I'm going to read is from my most recent collection of short stories, which is called Loot. And the title of the story is The Generation Gap. He was the one told, James, the youngest of them, the father to the son, and it was Jamie, with whom he'd never got on since Jamie was a kid, Jamie who ran away when he was adolescent and was brought back resentful, nothing between them but a turned aside head, the boys, and the tight, tolerant jaw of suppressed disapproval, the father's. Jamie, who was doing he's running a cyber surfers restaurant with a friend, that's the latest. He's done so many things, but the consensus in the family is that he's the one who's done nothing with his life. His brothers and sisters love him, but see it as a waste of charm and some kind of ill-defined talent, sensed but not directed in any of the ways they recognize. So it was from Jamie that they received the announcement. The father had it conveyed by Jamie to them, Virginia, Barbara, and Matthew, who was called at some unearthly hour in Australia. The father has left the mother. A husband leaves his wife. It's one of the most unexceptional of events. The father has left the mother. That's a completely different version. Their version. A husband leaves his wife for another woman, of course. Their father, their affectionate, loyal, considerate father, announces, just like that, he has left their mother for another woman. Inconceivable. And to have chosen, of all of them, the younger brother as confidant, confessor, messenger, or whatever the reasoning was, they talk to each other on the telephone. Calls those first few days frustratingly blocked while numbers were being dialed simultaneously and the occupied whine sounded on and on. Matthew in Brisbane sent an email. They got together in Barbara's house, his bar, his favourite, and even Jamie appeared, summoned, for an explanation he could not give. Why should I ask why? How? Or he would not give. The father must have said something beyond this announcement, but no. And Jamie had to get back to the bar nook and the espresso machine, leave them to it with his archaic smile of irresponsible comfort in any situation. And suddenly, from the door, his voice, "We're all grown up now." Yes, even he. It was established that no one had heard from the mother. Jenny had called her and waited to see if she would say anything, but she chatted about the grandchildren and the progress of a friend she'd been visiting in hospital. Not a word, but perhaps she doesn't know. But even if he kept the affair somehow secret from her until now, he would hardly inform his children before telling his wife of his decision to abandon her. Perhaps she thinks we don't know. No, can't you see? She doesn't want us to know because she thinks you'll come back and we don't ever need to know. A private thing, as Jamie said. Oh, that's ridiculous. She's embarrassed, ashamed. I don't know what, she's humiliated at the idea of us. Ginny had to intervene as chairperson to restore clarity out of the spurting crisscross of sibling voices. Now what do we do? What are we talking about? Are we going to try and change his mind, talk some sense into him? Are we going to go to her? We must, first of all. Then Barr should go. One would have thought Barr was the child he would have turned to. She said nothing, stirred in her chair and took a gulp of gin and tonic with a pull of lip muscles at the kick. There was no need to ask, why me? Because she's her daddy's favorite. She's closest to him, the one best to understand, if anyone can, what has led him to do what he's done. To himself, to their mother. And the woman? The voices rise as the temperature of the room. What about the woman? Anybody have any idea of who she might be? None of those wives in their circle of friends. It's Alistair, Ginny's husband, considering. Just look at them, your poor dad. But where did he and she ever go that he'd meet anyone new? Well, she'll know who it is. Bar will be told. Nothing sure about that. As the youngest of them said, they're all grown up. There are two among the three present, and that's not counting sports commentator Matthew in Brisbane, who know how affairs may be and are concealed. It's only if they take the place of a marriage that they have to be revealed. Sick, that's what it is. He's sick. Bar, all of them anticipating for Bar to deal with her mother, expected tears and heartbreak to burst the conventions that protect the intimacy of parents' marriage from their sons and daughters. But there are no tears. Derision and scorn from their mother become the discarded wife. Indeed, she knows who the woman is. A pause, as if the daughter, not the mother, were the one who must prepare herself. She's exactly your age, Bar. And the effect is what the mother must have counted on as part of the kind of triumph she's set herself to make of the disaster, deflecting it to the father. The woman has a child, never been married. What does she do? Plays the fiddle in an orchestra. How and where he found her, God only knows. You know we never go to concerts. He has his CD collection here in this room. Everything's been just as usual while it's been going on. He says he's very exact for 8 months. So when he finally had the courage to come out with it, I told him, 8 months after 42 years, you've made your choice. May he survive it. When I said, it's Bar reporting, doesn't sound as if it will work for him. It's just an episode, something he's never tried, never done, a missing experience. He'll come back to his life. Of course, that would be the way Bar would put it. She said, the mother, I won't give it back to him. I can tell you what she's like. I can't tell you. It's as if the place they were in together, not just the house, it's barricaded. Our mother's in there, guns cocked. What can they do for her? Their mother, who doesn't want sympathy, doesn't want reconciliation brokered, even if it were to be possible, doesn't want the healing of their love, any kind of love, if the love of 42 years doesn't exist. His Bar offers to bring the three available of his sons and daughters together again to meet him at her house, at Bar's house, but he tells her he would rather spend time with each separately. She is the last he comes to, and his presence is strange both to him and to her. How can it be otherwise? When he sleeps with a woman, she could have been his daughter. It's as if something forbidden has happened between him and his favorite child. Something unspeakable exists. Bar has already heard it all before. All he will allow himself to tell from the others. Same story to Ginny, Jamie, and according to an email from Matthew in Australia, much the same in a bloody awful call to him. Yes, she's not married, this woman. Yes, she plays second violin in a symphony orchestra. And yes, she is 35 years old. He looks up slowly and he gives his daughter this fact as if he must hold her gaze and she cannot let hers waver, a secret between them. So she feels able to ask him what the others didn't, perhaps because the inquiry might somehow imply acceptance of the validity of happenstance in a preposterous decision of a 67-year-old to overturn his life. How did he meet this woman? He shapes that tight, tolerant jaw, now not of disapproval. He has no right to that in the circumstances, but of hurt resignation to probing. On a plane. On a plane? The daughter cannot show her doubtful surprise. When did he ever travel without mother? While he continues, feeling himself pressed to it, he went to Cape Town for negotiations with principals from the American company who didn't have time to come to him up in Pretoria. The orchestra was going to the coast to open a music festival. He found her beside him. They got talking, and she kindly offered to arrange a seat for him at the oversubscribed concert. And then? But her poor father, she couldn't humiliate him. She couldn't follow him, naked, the outer inner man she'd never seen, through the months in the woman's bed beside the violin case. "What are you going to do?" she asked. "It's done." That's what he said. The siblings compared notes afterwards. And he gave such explanation as he could. Practical. "I've moved out. But Isabel must have told you. I've taken a furnished flat. I'll leave the number. I'd rather you didn't call at the office at present." "And then? What will happen to you, my poor father?" But all she spoke out was, "So you want to marry this girl?" For in comparison with his mate, his wife of 42 years, his 67 years, she's no more than that. "I'll never marry again." "Yes, he told the others that too. Is the vehemence prudence, the huge age difference for God's sake, Matthew says from Australia, or is it telling them something about the marriage that produced them? Some parental sorrow they weren't aware of while in the family home, or ignored, too preoccupied with their own hived-off lives to bother with after. There's nothing wrong between Isabel and me, but for a very long time there's been nothing right either. Wishing you every happiness, the wedding gift, Maxim. Grown apart? Put together mistakenly in the first place? They're all of them, the children, too close to the surface marriage created for them, in self-defense and protection of them, the children, no doubt, to be able to speculate. And what is going to happen to our mother, your Isabel? And then, that concert. After the indigestion of a three-hour lunch and another 3 hours of business-speak wrangling I had with those jocular sharks from Seattle, Mahler's Symphony No. 1. I've forgotten. There's no comparison between listening to recorded music in a room filled with all the same things, the photographs, the glass, the coffee cup in your hand, the chair that fits you, and hearing music live. Seeing it as well, that's the difference. Because acoustically, reproduction these days is perfect. I know I used to say it was better than the bother of driving to concerts. Watching the players, how they're creating what you're hearing, their movements, their breathing, the expressions of concentration, even the way they sit, sway in obedience to the conductor. He's a magician transforming their bodies into sound. I don't think I took particular notice of her. Maybe I did without knowing it. These things are a human mystery, I've realized. But that would have been that. She told me her name, but I didn't know where she lived, so I wouldn't even have known where to thank her for the concert reservation. If it hadn't been that she was on the plane again the next day when I was returning home. We were seated in the same row, both aisle seats, separated this time only by that narrow gap we could naturally talk across. About the concert, what it was like to be a musician. People like myself are always curious about artists. And she was teasing, saying we regard theirs as a free, undisciplined life compared with being, myself, a businessman. But it was a much more disciplined life than ours. The rehearsals, the performance, the red-eye night work, endless overtime, she called it. While we others have regular hours and leisure. We had the freebie drink together and a sort of mocking argument about stress, hers facing an audience and knowing she'd get hell afterwards if she played a wrong note, and mine with the example of the principals from Seattle the day before. The kind of exchange you hear strangers making on a plane and that I always have avoided. I avoid now talking about her to my children. What can you call sons and daughters who are far from children? I know they think it's ridiculous. It's all ridiculous to them. But I don't want anyone running around making inquiries about her, her life, as if her suitability is an issue that has anything to do with them. But of course, everything about what I suppose must be this called an affair has to do with them because it's their mother, someone they've always seen, will see, as the other half of me. They'll want to put me together again. The children. He's right. What do you call a couple's grown-up children? They'd found weeks go by without meeting one another or getting in touch. Ginny is a lecturer in the maths department at the university, and her husband is a lawyer. Their friends are fellow academics and lawyers, with a satisfying link between the two in concerns over the need for a powerful civil society to protect human rights. Their elder son and daughters are almost adult, and they have a latecomer, a 4-year-old boy. Bar, she's barren. Ginny is the repository of the secret of her childlessness. Bar and her husband live in the city as week-long exiles from the bush. Carl was manager of a wildlife reserve when she fell in love with him. He now manages a branch of clothing chain stores, and she's personal secretary to a stockbroker. Every weekend they're away, camping and walking, incommunicado to humans, animal watching, bird watching, insect watching, plant identifying, returning to the lover arms of the felt. As Ginny and Alistair have remarked, if affectionately, her sister and brother-in-law are more interested in buck and beetles than in any endangered human species. Jamie, to catch up with him, except for Christmas, he was all over the place other than where you'd expect to find him. And Matthew, he was the childhood and adolescence photographs displayed in the parents' house, and a commentator's voice broadcasting a test cricket match from Australia, in which recognizable quirks of home pronunciation came and went like the fading and return of an unclear line. Now they're in touch again, as they've not been since a time. Oh, times they wouldn't remember, or would remember differently, each according to a need that made this sibling then seek out that, while avoiding the others. Ginny and Bar even meet for lunch. It's in a piano bar cum bistro, with deep armchairs and standing lamps which fan a sunset light to the ceiling, beneath which you eat from the low table at your knees. It's a most unlikely place to be chosen by Bar, who picks at the spicy olives and peri-peri cashew nuts as if she were trying some unfamiliar seed come upon in the wild. But she suggested the place because she and Carl don't go to restaurants, and it's the one she knows of since her stockbroker asks her to make bookings there for him. When the sisters meet, they don't know where to begin. The weeks go by when the phone rings and, fairly regularly, duty-bound, it's the father. Or, rarely, she's in a mood when duty is seen to be a farce, it's the mother. The siblings have a high moment when it could be another announcement. That it's over. He's back. She's given his life back to him, the 42 years. But no, no. May he survive. That's the axiom the daughters and sons have, ironically, taken from her. Who is this woman who threatened? Her name is Alicia. Affected choice on the part of whoever engendered her. Surname Parks. Commonplace enough, which explains a certain level of origin, perhaps. She was something of a prodigy for as long as childhood lasts, but has not fulfilled this promise and has ended up no further than second violinist in a second-best symphony orchestra. so rated by people who really know music, which the father, poor man, doesn't. Just his CD shelf in the living room for relaxation with his wife on evenings at home. The woman's career will have impressed him. Those who can, play. Those who can't, listen. He and Isabel. What happened to the man, father of the child? Has their father a rival? Is he a hopeful sign? Or, indeed, is he a threat? A complication in the risk the darling, crazy 67-year-old is taking. Next thing is he'll be mixed up in some crime passionnel. But Jamie, captured for drinks at Ginny's house, just laughs. Daddy-o, right on. The older man has appeal. And Jamie's the one who does what as youngsters they called picking up stompies, cigarette butts of information and gossip. The child's father lives in London. He's a journalist, and he's said to be coloured. So the little boy to whom he, father, must be paying surrogate father, is a mixed-blood child, twice or thrice diluted, since the father might be heaven knows what concoction of human variety. At least that shows this business has brought progress in some way. Ginny is privately returning to something in her own experience of the parental home. Only one other sibling, Matthew, happens to know about. The parents had always affirmed they were not racist and brought up their children that way, so far as they felt they could, without conflict with the laws of the time. Ginny, as a student, had a long love affair with a young Indian who was admitted to study at the White University on a quota. She never could tell the parents. When it came to a daughter or son of their own, the fact of the child obviously doesn't matter to him now. Of course, the mother, in her prison mood, if she should get to hear. Ginny was at a door of the past, opening contiguous to the present. You never know about anything like that. Principles. Look at me. I wear a ribbon in support of no discrimination against AIDS victims. But what if I found the woman who takes care of my kid was HIV positive? Would I get rid of her? Alistair, merely a husband among them, had something to say to the siblings. The matter of the child might be an added attraction for him, the rainbow child. Many well-meaning people in the past now want somewhere to prove in practice the abstract positions they hid in then. Of course, I don't know your father as well as you lot do. His wife had something to add. Or as we think we do. Barr did not speak at these family meetings. She is in a house now with her father. The house is something familiar to her, but it isn't either the family home or her own. Or maybe it's both. Dreams can do these things. Just she and her father. She wonders why he's there in the middle of the day. He says he's waiting for the arrival of the maid. There's the tring-tring of an old-fashioned bicycle bell, the kind they had on their bikes as children. She looks out the window. He's standing behind her, and she sees, they see, she's aware he knows she's looking, a young and pretty red-haired stroke blonde dismount from a bicycle, smiling. But there are no whites who work as maids in this country. Ginny and Barr, not telling anyone else, go to a concert. Seats chosen neither too near nor too far back. Yes, she is there with the violin nestling between jaw and shoulder. Follow the white hands doing different intricate things, some fingers depressing strings, those of the other hand folded round the bow. She wears the sort of informal evening dress the other women players in the orchestra wear. Not quite a uniform, the equivalent of the not quite black tie outfits the male players allow themselves, roll collar shirts and coloured cummerbunds. There's some sort of fringed shawl slipped off the side of the bowing arm. Apparently the dress is quite sexily décolleté. They verify this when the orchestra rises at interval. She's certainly very slim, the left leg stretched gracefully, and there's a lot of hair piled on the top of her head, not blonde, not redhead. It's the colour of every second woman's at present, an unidentifiable brown overlaid with a purplish shine of henna. She rests her bow, plays when summoned by the conductor, and the sisters are summoned to listen to her. They feel she knows they are there, although she doesn't know them. She's looking at them, although blinded by the stage lights. She's playing to them. The palm of the hand. All that you go through your life, 67 years, how long it's been, without knowing. Most of it you'll never suspect you lack, and it's pure chance that you may come upon. An ordinary short flight between one familiar city and another in daily, yearly time. The palm of a hand, that it can be so erotic. Its pads and valleys and lines to trace and kiss. She laughs at me and says, they're lines of fortune. That's why I'm here with her. The palm that holds, enfolds the rod of the bow, and it sings. Enfolds, holds me. Matthew mustn't think he can stay out of it. They send him email letters, dispatched by Ginny, but addressing him as from a collective we, the sisters and their husbands, the younger brother. And they expect him to take part in decisions, whatever there is to be done. Matthew writes, I suppose we gave them the general amount of trouble sons and daughters do, the parents, he means. And what is meant by that? What's that got to do with anything that can be done? What's he getting at? Is it that it's the parents' turn now? For God's sake, at their age? At his age? Or is it just because of their past youth, the sons and daughters ought to understand the parents better? All these irrelevances, who knows, they come upon, brought up by the one nice and far away among the cricket bats and the kangaroos. What is there for Matthew to disinter? He was always so uncomplicated. So far as they know, those who grew up close to him in the entanglements of a family never ran away from anything, unless you count Australia, where he's made what is widely recognized as a success. The general amount of trouble. Oh, Jamie. And for the parents, he's unlikely ever to be regarded as anything other than troubling. As long as they're happy, parents say of their engendered adults, swallowing dismay and disappointment. What did the parents really know of what was happening to their young back then? Ginny's Indian. The irony. She sees it now. That it was his parents who found out about the affair and broke it off. Never mind falling in love. That kind of love was called miscegenation in those days, punishable by law, and would have put his studies at risk. His parents planned him to be a doctor, not a lover, in prison. Bar's abortion. How he, the father, would have anguished over his favorite daughter if he had known. Only Ginny knows that this botched backroom process is the reason why Bar is childless. No one else. Not Carl, her husband. It belongs to a life before Bar found him, her rare and only elect mate, come upon in the bush. It's unlikely that Jamie has a passing thought in the reminder of the general amount of trouble they've given for what he arranged for his frantic sister that time. Because even as a teenager, he had precociously the kind of friends who were used to mutual efforts in getting one another out of all manner of youthful trouble. Yes, it was Jamie. Jamie of all of them, Bart turned to. As it was Jamie. Jamie of all of them, her father had turned to in his trouble, now. It became possible to have him to eat a meal at one or other of their homes without the mother. As if it were normal. And not easy to convey to him implicitly that it was not, that his place as a lover was not at this table. His place here was as a husband with his wife, mother and father. This displacement did not apply to their mother because she, as they saw it, was the victim of this invading lover in the family circle. She had accepted to come to them, in her own right, so to speak, now and then, her carefully erected composure forbidding any discussion of the situation at table. And now she'd gone to spend a holiday with her cousin, a consular official in Mauritius. After the meal with her at Ginny's or Bar's house, one of them, her daughters or their husbands, insisted on a sense of reality by bringing up the subject, the only subject. How did things stand now? Was there any exchange of ideas, say, about the future going on between him and her? Her lawyer had met him, and an allowance for her had been arranged. There were other matters to be cleared up. Possessions. These were not specified, as if it had nothing to do with anyone but herself. It was Carl who was able to say, out of his privileged innocence, close to nature's organic cycles of change and renewal, "Maybe your absence will be the right thing. For both of you, when you come back, you may find you can work things out again together." She looked at him half pityingly for his concern. "Things are worked out. It was his work." And she turned away, as of her right, to grandmotherly talk with Ginny's small boy, for whom she had bought a model jeep, and then to a low exchange in intimate tone with her favourite, the elder of the two teenage daughters, who happened to be at home in the family that evening. "No boyfriends around tonight? Usually when I come at the weekend, I hear a lot of music and laughing going on upstairs." "Helen's friends," the girl says. "Ah, and not yours, not your type, I understand. What's your type? All right, the one, then. I have a pretty good idea of what would interest you, you know." And the girl lies, describing the non-existent one as she thinks an adult would wish him to be. When the mother-grandmother had left, Ginny's husband, Alistair, told them, "Isabel thinks we're on his side. That's the problem." "Why should we be?" Nobody takes up Bar's statement. "May he survive. Best of all, early in the morning some days, to wake at the sound of the key turning in the lock, her key, hear it, but not sufficiently awake to open eyes, and there's a cold, fresh cheek laid against the unshaven one. She's left her apartment before 7 to deliver the child to nursery school, and after, she's suddenly here. Yesterday, heard her shoes drop and opened eyes to follow her clothes to the floor. She glides into bed, the cheek is still cold, and the rest of her is her special warmth. Not today, waiting for the key to turn. Tomorrow, again it will turn, again and again." They broached to one another the obligation, the usefulness, perhaps, of inviting him to bring her along sometime, this woman. Sunday lunch? No, that's too familiar a gesture. And of course, Bar and Carl wouldn't be there. Why should Ginny and Alistair deal with this on their own? And you can't count on Jamie. "Come by for a drink, six-ish, that would do. What's she like, look like?" The two men want to know in advance. After all, they are the father's fellow males. What do you expect in order to put themselves in his place, so to speak? But the splash of stage lights dropped a mask on faces that time. There were cave hollows of eyes, white cheeks, bright mouth. It was the hands in movement by which an identity was followed. The man who brings her to Ginny's house is another personage. Their father? He who always listened, now talks. Although this is not his home, he's not the host. He rises to refill glasses and offer snacks. He is courting her in front of them. They see it. Their mother is much better looking, still beautiful. This one has a long, thin, voracious face. The light didn't exaggerate its hollows. And her intelligently narrowed eyes, hazel, greenish, doesn't matter, They're iconized by makeup in the style of Egyptian statues. She's chosen a loose but clinging tunic, and the sisters see that she has firm breasts. When they compare impressions afterwards, it seems it was the women who noticed this, rather than, as one would have thought, the men. Her hands are unadorned, oh, the mother has gifts of beautiful rings from him over the years, and the hands lie half-curled, the palms half-open on chair arm or lap. It's as if the hands' lack of tension is meant to put them at ease, these hands that make music and pleasure their father. She has a voice with what the women suspect is an adopted huskiness they believe men find attractive. It turns out no one of the men, Jamie was also present, noticed it either as an affectation or an attraction he might have responded to. The talk was quite animated and completely artificial. They were all other people, chatting about nothing that mattered to whom and what they really were. There are so many harmless subjects. You can really get along in any situation by sticking to what has been in the newspapers and on television about the floods, droughts, the times of day to avoid driving in traffic congestion, and keep off wars and politics, both local and international. Those are intimate subjects. And of course, the subject of music came up. It is the lover who brings that up. Ginny and Barr would have preferred to keep off that too. She might somehow sense how their eyes had been upon her while she played that time. He even boasts about her. You know, Alicia will go with the orchestra to an international music festival in Montreal in the winter, and it will be particularly enjoyable for her because Alicia also speaks fluent French. He might, he ought to be, boring someone with the achievements of his 17-year-old granddaughter, Ginny's oldest child. Ginny's biological afterthought, the 4-year-old Sean, had been playing with his Jeep around everyone's feet. When the father and his woman were leaving, she bent to the child. "I've got a little boy like you, you know. He has a collection of cars, but I don't think he has a Jeep. Yours is great." They're not embarrassed about anything, these lovers. The new father of some other man's progeny makes a pledge for the rainbow child. "We'll have to find one for him. Where'd you get it?" Sean asserts the presence not admitted to the drinks party. "My grandmother did bring it for me." A curious, almost shaming moment comes to the siblings and husbands when they suddenly laugh about the whole business. Mother, father, the woman. It begins to happen when they get together, less and less frequently, dutifully to try and decide yet again what they ought to be doing about it. The outbreak's akin to the hysterical giggle that sometimes accompanies tearful frustration. What can you do about Papa in his bemused state? And oh my God, next thing is he'll get her pregnant. He'll be Daddy all over again. No, spare us that. What do you mean no? Presumably that's what it's all about. His pride in an old man's intact male power. And Alistair, in an aside to Jamie, apparently is still able to get it up. "Right on, as you would say." And they all lose control and laugh again. Now, what is there to do with the mother who is unapproachable, wants to be left alone like a sulky teenager, and a father who's broken loose like a youth sowing wild oats? Who could ever do anything with people in such conditions? Ah, but these are mature people. So nobody knows what maturity is, after all. Is that it? Not any longer, not any more, now that the mother and father have taken away that certainty from their sons and daughters. Matthew calls and sends an email from his safe distance, reproaching. "What's the matter with all of you? Why can't you get some reality into them? Bring them together for what's left after their 42 years. How else can this end?" Well, the mother seems to be making an extended holiday of a lifetime out of the situation. And he's out of reach, spaced out, Jamie says, dancing to a fiddle, shaking their heads with laughter that dies in exasperation. There's nothing you can do with the parents. Only fear for them. Ba's tears are not of laughter. At least adolescents grow up. That could have been counted on to solve most of the general trouble they'd given. In the circumstances of parents, it seems there isn't anything to be counted on, least of all the much-vaunted wisdom of old age. The mother wrote a long, round-robin letter, copied to each sibling, just a different name after dearest, telling them that she was going to Matthew in Australia. So Mauritius had been halfway there, halfway from her rightful home, all along, in more than its geographical position across the Indian Ocean between Africa and Australia. She would keep house in Matthew's bachelor apartment while she looked for a place of her own, with space enough for them to come and visit her. Send the grandchildren. Alicia Parks, second violinist, did not return from Montreal. He continued to exchange letters and calls with her over many months. The family gathered this when he gave them news of her successes with the orchestra on tour, as if whether this was of interest or welcome to them or not. They must recognize her as an extension of his life and therefore theirs. They, it obviously implied, could make up their minds about that. What he did not tell them was that she had left the orchestra at the invitation to join a Montreal chamber group as first violinist, an ambition he knew she had and he wanted to see fulfilled for her. But Canada, she had taken into consideration, that was her phrase, that there were not many such opportunities for her back in Africa with him. In his long late-night calls to her, he completed to himself what she didn't say, with him. She sent for her child, told him only after the child had left the country. Then she did not tell him that she was with someone other than her child, a new man. But he knew from her voice. Ginny came out with it to their father. Is she coming back? When she gets suitable engagements here, of course, she's made a position for herself in the world of music. So he's waiting for her, they decided. Poor man. Why can't he accept it's over, inevitably put the whole thing behind him? Come back to aging as a father. There's a dignified alternative to this disastrous regression to adolescence. May he survive. Together and individually, they are determined in pursuit of him. The best was a cold cheek, just that. What alternative to that? In the mirror in the bathroom, there was her body as she dried herself after the lovemaking bath together, toweling between her spread legs and then across the back of her neck as beautifully as she bowed across the violin, steam sending trickles of her hair over her forehead. A mirror full of her. For me, old lover, she knew how to love so well, so well. Her old lover, 67. What alternative? Death is a blank mirror, emptied of all it has seen and shown. Death waits, was waiting, but I took the plane to Cape Town instead.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
I was very struck in your reading, your beautiful reading of that very moving story. I was struck by several things. One, of course, it's a delight to hear an author read her own work and to give to the reader to hear the pauses and the inflections of the sentences, which sometimes when one is reading a work oneself, one rushes over too quickly. So it had, for me at any rate, an additional meaning. I was very struck, among other things in the story, by the sentence, "They were all other people." And it seemed to me that it almost could be said of very many of your stories and very many of the novels that one of the central existential predicaments of your characters is the effort to really determine who they are in a world which puts a kind of extraordinary pressure on them to behave unknowingly to themselves. Do you have that sense about your characters?
Not quite. I have a slightly different take on this. I don't think one ever knows anybody, even someone that you live with intimately for years. We all of us are known differently to different people. And we are not whole, so to speak. The many different sides of our characters and the way that we react and respond, we are other people in that sense. That the two of us talking here now, we have a certain relationship here tonight. I might meet somebody tomorrow who knows you in a different situation and has a completely different idea of the kind of person that you are. I think that we are many people, all of us.
But I think particularly in the early decades and continuing under the decades when the apartheid regime was most fierce, the inability of people to see the individuals, but instead prevented from seeing them by the color bar, imposed on everyone in the society, did it not, a degree of armature that it was necessary to try to pierce just to behave normally.
Yes, because you see, one was defined from outside by law, so to speak. You were told, right, you are white and you have certain a way of life and you have certain opportunities that are open to you, and this person is half white, is mixed blood, and has another position, and then you have the South African Indians, people of Indian descent, not your kind of Indians, but from India, and they had even different sets of laws. They were differently restricted. Right at the bottom of the pile, of course, was the great black majority, who had virtually no rights at all, but there were these stages leading up to the freedom that whites had, so that you were literally defined by the fact that, for instance, I could use the library, and if I'd been black or colored or Indian, I would not have been allowed to use the library.
Now, you first started going to the library at a fairly young age. Nadine Gordimer grew up in a small town outside of Johannesburg. Springs, it was the
Yes,
title.
There were no springs at all. I don't know where I got that name.
So in some strange and magical way, like Athena being born fully formed from the head of that great god, she invented herself, the daughter of a Latvian Jewish watch repairer?
Yes, that's what he'd been trained to do back in what I suppose you would call his old country.
So how did
But
you...
actually he had a shop, he didn't, and he employed somebody else to mend the watches. But he sold all sorts of things. You see, it was a mining town, and so obviously people got engaged and married and bought rings and things, and then people were given presentation clocks and things like this when they left the mine or moved up to a higher grade. So it was that sort of mixed thing.
And you once wrote an essay in which you described yourself, or had been described at the time, during the time when you were going to elementary school, as a bolter, as someone who bolted from the classroom, who was unhappy with its confinements.
Yes, I was a great bolter. I was always running away from school. It was a convent school, and there were prayers in the Catholic Church, which was attached to the school. But those of us who were not Catholics didn't go. We were supposed to hang around in the classroom and look over our homework. But several times I just disappeared then and ran away, crossed the open ground, the veld where I had come to school, and spent the morning catching butterflies and enjoying myself, and turned up back at school in time, either to be fetched by my mother or take the bus home. But of course, it was found out in the end that I was not present when I should have been.
So how did you find yourself to be a writer?
From being a reader.
And what prompted you to fall in love with reading?
Well, first of all, I was fortunate enough to be read to by my mother when I was a small child. And when I was 6 years old, indeed, you could be made a member of the children's branch of the local library. And so she immediately did that. And it was a great treat every Saturday to go and get one's two books or whatever they were. So that I had a great deal of encouragement from my mother, and I learned to read very young. So.
And when did you first become conscious that something was not altogether right in the country you were growing up in?
It's difficult to put an exact... I should think probably the age of about 12, because I was brought up in this completely white enclave, except, of course, that we had a servant, a black servant, who indeed, very much like the situation in the South in this country, who was a sort of second mother, and even had the authority to give me three on the bottom if I didn't behave myself. So that there was this strong relationship then with her. But at the same time, it was quite understood by us, by my sister and by me, that, for instance, the cups and glasses that were in the kitchen that were used by her, that we mustn't drink out of them. Absolutely astonishing. I don't know why this was thought that she was going to give us some terrible disease if we drank out of the same cup, but that's how it was. But when I was about 12, at that time one of the other laws was that black people couldn't buy liquor and couldn't indeed go into a bar or do anything like that. So, of course, everybody made home brew, you know. Every second household was being made in the backyard. And then the police used to come on raids. And I think that was really, that comes to my mind when I look back as the time when I became conscious there was something wrong. Because we were all in bed, and suddenly there was a noise in the garden and in the yard. So my parents got up, and I got up, and went out and found the police were there, black policemen led by a white sergeant, and they were in her humble room, and they turned her bed upside down and they pulled out her things because they thought she might be brewing beer. They were looking for beer. Now, they had walked into my parents' property without a warrant of any kind, but my parents just stood by, and we all stood by and watched this, and nobody did anything. And then the police went away, and the poor woman was crying and put her things back in some order. But since my parents did nothing, they obviously thought this was quite all right. And one of my first stories came indeed from that, about perhaps 2 years later, stuck in my mind so strongly that I wrote a story about it, which was actually published in a small magazine.
Mm-hmm. I possess a... Nadine Gordimer began to be published very early. And I believe when you were 26, your first story was published, taken up by The New Yorker. And then in 1953, some of the stories appeared in a quarterly called New World Writing. And then shortly thereafter, Simon and Schuster began to publish.
But I've already published a book of stories in South Africa.
You had? Mm. Well, that raises an interesting point.
In 1948. Mm. History, long ago.
History, long ago.
Most of you were not born, but there you are.
And you would go on to write many books, at least three of them banned, at least for a time.
One was banned for 12 years, and the others for varying times, depending upon how long we came along to our liberation, you know, how near or far we were from it.
So how did it happen that you managed to somehow avoid that terrible disease that afflicts too many writers who find themselves enrolled in a political cause so vigorously and so intensely that it deforms their art. How is it that you somehow remain vigorous in your obligations as a citizen in the Republic of Letters, and at the same time have been able to invest your characters with a degree of humanity that often eludes writers who are committed to political causes?
Well, I don't know. I was either extremely selfishly guarding whatever talent that I knew I had, or it was totally schizophrenic that I had two identities and managed to keep them apart. It wasn't so difficult, really, because it required a lot of discipline. But I think writers, we are solitary workers anyway. That's the nature of our work. So we have to, if we can't discipline ourselves, we're never going to do anything. But the rule I made, and that was quite difficult, because once I had the ability to write, the temptation to become a propagandist. But I didn't allow that, and to make all my characters who were on the political side that I was on, to make them all angels and everybody else devils. But I never gave in to that. I kept my writer's right to see that human beings are a mass of contradictions. That's the fascination of being a writer, I think. So I managed to keep that apart, and in my life as a citizen, and particularly as a white, in the position it was then, I couldn't just sit back in an ivory tower and say, I'm a writer, and that's it. Everybody else, I will somehow keep the spirit that is in the country going in my writing, but I will not take any active part. But I couldn't do that.
For you, has the end of apartheid been a kind of liberation with regard to your writing?
No, but to me as a human being, as a person, certainly has been an enormous liberation. But with my writing, you know how we are. Whatever is happening is affecting us, and our writing is acting upon that, so to speak. So that your perceptions and your transformation of these perceptions move along as your society changes. It's very often happened to me in this last almost decade since we've been free. Journalists say to me, as they do to my fellow writers, what are you going to write about now that your subject has gone? and my rather irritated answer is, you know, life didn't end with apartheid. Indeed, it began in many ways.
It would appear that the story you read tonight is certainly evidence that the storytelling hasn't gone away, and there's quite a lot still to talk about.
Oh, a great deal.
Did you think you would live to see the collapse of apartheid?
God, I began to think no. You know, the beginning of the 80s was such a bad time, because when a repressive regime sees that it's got its back to the wall, it's then an absolute fury. I think this happens everywhere. And that's the time when I wrote July's People, the only sort of prophetic book that I've ever written, because it seemed to me that we were going to end up very soon in a civil war. The whites were not giving an inch, and the blacks in South Africa were gaining unity and strength. And we were not doing too badly in Mkhonto we Sizwe, Spear of the Nation, the guerrilla war that was going on indeed in countries we were fighting from another country back in our own. So it seemed then that it was going to end up in a terrible situation with blood in the streets and us killing each other. And then, quite miraculously, and I think one can only be astounded at the amazing tolerance of black South Africans. That they were fighting, we had incidents of violence, we had bombs in a bar, two bars, we had bombs in a station, but mostly the targets that the African National Congress concentrated on were targets that didn't involve people, that they would blow up pylons, knock out power, things like this. But there were very few instances where people were killed, which was an amazing, I don't know how they held back. from that.
Certainly it was an astonishing and altogether surprising passage from the bitterness of that despotic regime to Mandela's release from prison after 27 years, rivaling in the surprising collapse of communism that occurred so peaceably. No one expected either of these events to transpire in the way that they did. I know that you titled a collection of yours called Living in Hope and History, which is derived, for those of you who don't know it, we share a common admiration for the work, as I think you do. He was here, I think, earlier in the year, Seamus Heaney.
Where was he? Seamus was here.
The title is derived from a verse of Heaney's in his verse a play called The Curate Troy, and it goes, if I can recall it, history says, don't hope on this side of the grave. But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of injustice can rise up and hope and history rhyme. You've been very privileged to live at a moment in your country when that
took place. Yes, it really was wonderful.
Both took place.
My husband, Ronald Kassira, and I really thought it's going on so long that we would be dead before it happened. And it was an incredible experience. But for me, before apartheid was officially ended, there was an event that, to me, was the beginning of it. And that was, funnily enough, it coincided almost in a matter of a couple of weeks with the fall of the Berlin Wall, with the wall going down. That was October 89, yes. Not Mandela, but Walter Sisulu, our other great hero, Walter Sisulu and others whose names might not be familiar to you. They were let out, having been 20 years or so, you know, on Robben Island. And there was a huge welcome for them in a big sports stadium at the edge of Soweto. And this was astonishing, to go there, and there were no dogs and tear gas and policemen around. And it was an enormous thing. Apartheid was still there, but somehow they felt they couldn't hold us back any longer. And to me, that was really the end of apartheid.
So, do you disagree with the statement that Bertolt Brecht once made, happy the country that has no need of heroes?
Well, I think if we keep the reservation has no need, fine, because it means it's a peaceful country. But on the other hand, I think it's in a novel of mine called Berger's Daughter, someone observes how terrible it was living as it was then in the apartheid situation, with so much that was inhuman going on around you. But it was still incredible to live in a country where there are still heroes, because there's so much that is shabby in the world, so much that is underhand and corrupt, that to have people that you really can wholeheartedly admire who are totally heroic is something very unusual.
It seems that South Africa was really blessed in Mandela and a number of the others,
yes,
that they were men and women of extraordinary character, able to be so unburdened and with such sobriety and not filled with the bitterness that one would have thought their years being repressed would have led to.
No, it's really quite amazing. A very good young friend of mine, Morakabi Seakwa, who used to be the general secretary of our writers' organization. And he is the most well-balanced, happy, vital person, ready to try anything, always with new ideas, either for work that he wants to do or plans that he has for other people. He, at the age of, from the age of 17, he was in the youth brigade of the ANC, and he was on Robben Island for 5 years. So imagine from the age of 17 from 17 to 22. I mean, the time when you're really enjoying life. But he has no bitterness at all about it. And he takes it as simply something that if he had his life over again, he would do it again.
Do you have any... What's your greatest regret?
My greatest regret is that I've never learnt an African language. We have 11 languages in my country. Two European languages, though of course Afrikaners would dispute that and say that Afrikaans, it was formed in South Africa, but it's formed out of European languages, mainly Dutch, as you know, with a bit of German and a few French words mixed up because of the Huguenots who came there after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes. So that there I have lived all this long life in South Africa with so many close friends and so much mixing, association with my own people, black people there. But I don't speak one of their languages. And often when people are in my house and I get up to go and make a cup of tea or to bring somebody a drink, then suddenly I hear a roar of laughter and a joke is being told in Tswana or Zulu or Venda or Khoza. And then I come back and it has to be explained to me as if I were a foreigner. And I regret this very much. And I could have done something about it. When I was at school, of course, we were not in the white school. You were not taught an African language. But I could have learned it when I was young. I could have learned it when I was middle-aged. But I never did, and I regret it tremendously.
Well, one could say of your writing that you nonetheless have, and is exemplified in the writing, an extraordinary ear for the vernacular of at least the English that was spoken in your country.
Yes, well, of course, our English is so mixed. I mean, there are a lot of words that come from African languages that I know and that I use, but that doesn't mean to say that I know the language. You know, it becomes a kind of jargon, especially the street language. And indeed, young people are beginning to write in that, we call it Tsotsi Tal. Tal is the Afrikaans word for language, and Tsotsi is a street kid, an urchin. So here you get two languages, Afrikaans and an African language mixed. And they're beginning to write in this strange English. A lot of Americanisms in it as well, coming from TV. But as we all know, it's not easy to find publication for this.
As you look over the course of your writing over the last half century, in your own judgment, how has the writing changed?
Oh, it's just changed along with the changes in the world and in my country. And the changes in myself, my experiences in life.
Well, I mean, what I mean by that is that it seems to me the more recent work of the last number of years has a kind of velocity and a certain clipped telegraphic quality to it that was less present.
Yes. Well, I think
starting out.
You know, when I was young, for instance, descriptions of nature. So I was seeing it for the first time, so to speak. But There are less and less descriptions of nature in my books and my stories. I realize that now.
Is that because there's less and less of nature to describe?
No, and I mean, I've always been... No, there's always plenty of nature. And indeed, I've always gone greatly in pursuit of nature. In my own country, in my own continent, I've traveled a lot in Africa, and it means a great deal to me. But it's strange. I don't know. I just feel that it's been described many times and that I'm not going to say something new about it. Though I still think, and I thought again on the long flights over from Africa and then from Mexico here, there are only two generations really, or perhaps three, not even three, that have seen the world. Right, people who were mountain climbers maybe looked down, but what we see from 30,000 feet, you know, has never been seen before. You don't have to be in space. You just have to be in an ordinary plane. And I often think that it's surprising that it hasn't influenced painters more. And I've often thought that if I were a painter, this is a kind of abstraction that would be extraordinary to capture, this removal from the earth and yet looking at it.
One could also make the argument that mass transportation, as well as photography, you'll forgive the expression, has rather ruined writing in a certain way. Mm-hmm. That is to say, the avalanche of images that have flooded the world, which is very different than the world of, say, 150 years ago, and the instantaneous nature of transportation means that even if you've never traveled to Paris, can anyone actually say that an actual trip to Paris will take them by surprise? The likelihood is that they will get off the plane and say, oh yes, the Eiffel Tower looks very much like I expected it to.
But you know, in another generation you got that from books. I went to...
Well, what I mean to say is that this obviates the need to describe what you're actually seeing.
True.
You only need to see, say, Paris, and everyone has knows where you are. Yeah. And it leads to a kind of telegraphic kind of style. And I wonder if that doesn't enfeeble, at least in less talented hands, writing.
I hope not. I don't like to hear of anything that enfeebles the written word. Absolutely anything.
Let's perhaps ask one or two more questions, because the sentiment of not wanting to hear about anything that enfeebles the written word is one I wholly subscribe to. We need all the readers we can get. Are you optimistic about reading?
No, I'm very troubled about it. I'm very troubled about it because I think the written word, and even when I say that, I see a capital W for that word, really. I think we have the word, and it's being threatened by the image. And you've only got to see, I think I mentioned to you today, but I mentioned again, that sometimes at home I've seen on a beach a family picnicking, and there's this lovely ocean, and there's the sand to be played with, and shells to be collected, and heaven knows what. And this kid is sitting there with a video game. And that is the kid who, instead of a bedtime story, has his supper and is put in front of the TV, and that's turned on. There's no more bedtime story. And so the love of reading, and then the desire to read yourself, all those of us who have been read to and then began to pick out and follow with a finger the word and recognize it, the thrill of that and saying, I can read, you know, to myself. That, it seems to me, is less and less being given over to the image. And even though that there are some good programs, I'm sure if you really make an analysis for yourself, it is the image that is more important than even the spoken word. It's the image that has the impact.
Yeah, one is almost tempted to say that reading is a kind of antisocial act. I mean, unlike watching movies or like going to a sports event or going to a music concert.
Because people don't read aloud anymore, the sort of family reading thing. That doesn't...
Yeah, well, how often do you recall as a child being immersed in a book and saying to someone, leave me alone, can't you see I'm reading?
Oh, yes. Yes, or going out and climbing into a tree and getting away from other people so that you could read. No, I think the book is very much threatened. And the great thing about it is that it doesn't need any device. It doesn't need a battery. It doesn't need electricity. No, there it is. And I would even make the point that you take it out of a library, it's free. Perhaps you have to pay a little yearly membership. If you buy it in a bookshop, there's no maintenance. You haven't got to find any kind of fuel for it. It just is yours forever.
Yeah, it does seem to me, however, that the predictions of the disappearance of the book are still premature, because despite all the seductions of the infotainment industry and the alleged joys of the Internet, the book does still remain the most single, accessible, even sensuous instrument for the conveyance of deep knowledge and lasting entertainment yet invented.
Well, I think so. But Steve, you've been in publishing and you know what goes on.
Past tense.
I said you have been in publishing,
yeah.
Yes. No. But publishers are all very doleful about the problems with people buying fewer books.
Well, I have to say, now that I work the other side of the street as editor of the Los Angeles Times Book Review, I don't notice any slackening in the annual production of book-like objects. In fact, I'm tempted to say that no work, however mediocre, goes unpublished.
Yes.
And the fact
that a lot of wonderful old books don't get republished, and people have never read them. And you get these small presses, fortunately, I think in this country you have quite a number of them, who specialize in this, or who specialize in translating people who are really unknown. When you think of, I think it's the Turnstile Press that has brought all the work of Joseph Roth, we would call it, but of course he's Joseph Roth, this marvelous...
Joseph Roth.
Yes, Joseph Roth.
We also share this enthusiasm in common.
Yes, yes. And they've taken the trouble to have new translations and to republish these books and introduce them. I know that even among my own friends, some people had never heard of him, and you couldn't get the books.
Right. Overlook Press has now republished almost all of Joseph Roth. I recommend it to him. Begin with Radetzky March and
yes.
Go through
Emperor's Tomb,
Emperor's Tomb, and all of them are quite wonderful. Well, it's one of the great scandals in this country, certainly, that the number of works from other languages that are now translated into English has fallen precipitously. It's dramatically down from what it was 35 years ago, even as the country trumps and thumps its chest, boasting about how more and more entangled we are in the world's affairs. What we know about the rest of the world seems to diminish.
Mm. But it's interesting how over the years of meetings in various countries between writers and publishers, always the same suggestion has been put forward and discussed and accepted most enthusiastically, that publishers should get together more and share the expense of translation, that there should be some kind of central exchange, so to speak. It's never happened.
Yeah, I don't think we'll see that happen.
No.
We have to have the kind of faith, it seems to me, that Arthur Koestler, the author of Darkness at Noon, once engaged in an interview, someone asked him, given a choice between having 10 readers 100 years from now or 100 readers in the present, which would you choose? And he said unhesitatingly, oh, 10 readers 100 years from now, and then paused and said, but I suppose such sentiment gives no cause for comfort to my publisher who hopes still to be in business.
No. Well, I don't know. I'm amazed that he said that, because surely you want to be read while you're alive. It's... I also think it's slightly pompous to be thinking that you'll be, you know, read in 100 years.
Well,
I'd just like to say something about, since we're talking of languages, you can imagine now in my country, free, we have no censorship at all. We have only one provision, which you might link with censorship, and that is if you publish hate speech. Of course, it's difficult to define hate speech, but there is hate speech, we all know it. The book will not be censored, but I write a book and it says all people who've got red hair or something should be killed, or, you know, there are always these prejudices of one kind or another that they are defiling the nation. You can take me to court for hate speech, but the book can't be banned. It will be so, but you can take me to court.
So the author can be ruined, but
yes,
the book survives.
And then, but I suppose the book eventually won't, in the end, won't survive either. But the fact is that there's no censorship board as there was, you know, during a large part of my lifetime. But I did something with one of my books that I'm very pleased that I did. That was Berger's Daughter. Now, I knew Berger's Daughter would be banned because I included in it verbatim certain little leaflets that suddenly used to be, just find them in the streets. And they were, of course, subversive. And I included them, one or two people either quoted from them, whatever. So I knew the book would have to be banned, and of course it was banned. But then I decided that I would try and find out who were these people on the board who read this book, and decided that it was so objectionable. One of the, I managed to get hold of, I found I had the right to get hold of their actual opinions. And this was so extraordinary, and they were so ignorant and pathetic, most of them, you know, that they weren't, it wasn't confined to my political sins in opposing the regime.
They must have fancied themselves literary critics.
Yes, for instance, one of the objectionable things was in the book, part of it takes place in France, and somebody goes to an exhibition, and a little child on the father's back, an American couple are there, and the child is overheard saying, looking at a crucifixion, old painting, but why has Jesus, why has he got dark hair? And he's quite, you know, he's not blonde, because at school and all the illustrations I see, Jesus is blonde and blue-eyed. And the father says, well, you know, he was in the Middle East, and it was very likely that indeed he was extremely dark. He might even have been almost black. Well, now, this was regarded as blasphemy. Yes? It was a blasphemous remark. So it was one of the reasons why the book had to be banned. Staggering.
Well, I would say, if I were a believing man, and I am not, God casts a very gentle eye on all blasphemers.
I think so. But we have the problem now of wanting to publish in African languages. Right. If you think there are nine indigenous languages, that sounds quite ridiculous. How can you even find a readership so spread? But the point is that these languages fall into groups, so that at least three of the languages I can think of, that would be Zulu, Ndebele, and one other, they are sufficiently close. They must have an ancient origin, so that people could read. If they belong to one group, they could probably read another. So you've got quite a spread. And in the major languages, such as Zulu and Xhosa, you've certainly got, you'd have a wide readership. And now, of course, there must be so many stories that people kept locked up inside them that they want to tell. And I think we'd have, there's a whole new readership out there that is now all only watching television, because there are no books in their languages, and their English isn't good enough for them to enjoy reading the books in English written by our own black writers who all write in English.
Well, there's no doubt that the challenge of overcoming that will be very great, but I, for one, retain the faith that as long as the human species is largely defined by our opposable thumb and our endless need, even obsessive need, to tell each other stories, sometimes the same story, over and over again, in new guise, the book or some form of it will not soon disappear.
No, but we don't want to see it decline either.
No, we don't. On that...
So for this Christmas, we'll all give everybody books. Not...
Well, I wonder if you all would join me in thanking Ms. Gordimer for her appearance tonight, and also to remember a remark that I believe Oscar Wilde once made. He said, anyone can make history. It takes a great person to write it. Nadine Gordimer has done both. Thanks so very much.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.